This is Patient Care Theory 2, Unit 6, Part 3, Neonatal Anomaly. So a small percentage of babies are born with cardiac anomalies, and that's what I'm going to talk about specifically, is cardiac anomalies. And recognizing these is not as critical as just simply recognizing the fact that, something's wrong with the infant, with the newborn, in the first 4 weeks, or the first 8 weeks, or the first 12 weeks, or what have you, doesn't matter. But it's recognizing that there's something abnormal, and that child warrants transport to hospital. So I'll talk about the following. These are the more common of the congenital anomalies: patent ductus arteriosus, ventricular septal defect, hypoplastic left heart syndrome, transposition of the great arteries, tetralogy of Fallot, coarctation of the aorta, persistent pulmonary hypertension in the newborn, and diaphragmatic hernia. So let's go through these one by one. So during fetal development, there's a vessel that anastomoses, in other words, connects between the pulmonary artery and the aorta. It's called a patent ductus arteriosus, and it is responsible for mixing of arterial and venous blood during fetal circulation, because that's one of the ways the fetus gets oxygenated. And a few days after birth, that vessel constricts and closes off, and it becomes becomes a ligament called the ligamentum arteriosum. And the ligamentum arteriosum is interesting for reasons we'll discuss later. But a patent ductus arteriosus beyond 10 days is a little abnormal. But when a baby's first born, they're going to have a patent ductus, and that's why we do a pulse oximetry on the right side. So they call it a preductal. So because the right subclavian artery comes off of the arch of the aorta, the right subclavian artery comes off here, and the patent ductus arteriosum will be around here, and the left subclavian artery is over on this side here. And so you're going to get a mix of venous and arterial blood, and as a consequence, if you were to take a pulse oximeter on the left side, you might get some really, really low saturations. Now, in a newborn, you're going to get normally low saturations for the first few minutes anyway, so don't be too upset about that. What we're interested in more than pulse oximetry in the newborn are, you know, whether they're vigorous, whether they've got you know, good respirations, good muscle tone, and a heart rate greater than 100, more so than the pulse oximetry reading. For the patent ductus to remain open beyond 10 days is abnormal, and there's going to be mixing of venous and arterial blood at that point, and that can put a strain on the heart and blood pressure in the lungs and the lung arteries. So this is just another image of the PDA, and eventually becomes a ligamentum arteriosum. I think we talked about chest trauma last year, if you recall, last semester, and we talked about this idea that the ligament, the extension of the ligamentum arteriosum, sort of connects the aorta to the spinal column. And when people are involved in really rapid acceleration, deceleration forces, so in a crash, for example, over 100 kilometers an hour, all the mediastinal structures, the heart, the great vessels, sort of propel forward and they strike the inner rib cage. But what also happens is, because the aorta is suspended to the spine by this ligamentum arteriosum, it can cause kinking of the aorta and tearing of the intimal layer of the artery, and resulting in aortic dissection. Right, so that's the sidebar about the patent ductus arteriosus, which becomes a ligamentum arteriosum eventually. So it's one of the more common congenital heart defects, and can be life-threatening the first few days of life. So mom comes home with a baby. 5 days later, they're calling 911 because this baby just doesn't look right. They're not behaving properly. They're maybe flaccid. They may be blue. Something's going on. I might have no idea what's going on with that baby. Chances are you're going to have not going on with that baby. You just know this baby is sick and get the hell out of there. That's all you're going to do, right? There might be some cardiac anomaly that requires ultrasound to diagnose. And you know, you can get the history in the back of the annals from them. So the frequency, pretty low for at terms, about 0.02 to 0.006% live births. And so that's, what is that, 6 in 1,000 or 6 in 10,000, 0.006. Help me out here. Is it 6 in 1,000? Or is it 6 in 10,000?
6 in 1,000.
6 in 1,000, good, okay. So if babies are born premature, the risk is higher, but it exceeds 30%, so quite a bit higher. So we want to ask about prematurity. We want to ask about any perinatal distress, so whether issues during labor, like whether one of the things mom will know about is she had a monitor on, she would know whether there were fetal heart decelerations, meaning the heart rates slowed down. About a third of children with PDAs are small for their age. And signs and symptoms are pretty vague. Tachypneic, tachycardia, maybe a murmur. Pretty vague, so listen to heart sounds. Management, pretty straightforward, supportive, right? Monitor vitals, SpO2 if indicated. Any altered LOC, we check a blood sugar, monitor ECG, and supportive care. So ABCs, O2 if they're low sat. But I know of a couple of calls where medics have been told by the parents, do not give my child oxygen under any circumstance, even if the kid's cyanosed. And so if the parent tells you that, just don't give them oxygen, because they've been told by a pediatrician that they've got an anomaly that can where oxygen might, that some children with certain cardiac anomalies are dependent on a patent ductus arteriosus to keep them alive, and oxygen can constrict that patent ductus, and that can be life-threatening for them. So parents know about their kids, and if a parent, I've only heard of this happening twice in my entire career. It's never been on the call that I've been on, but if a parent says, under no circumstances my child to get oxygen, don't act like you know better, you know, because you think everyone who's cyanosed gets oxygen, or everyone who has a low sac gets oxygen. Just follow the parents, you know, and just get that kid the hell out of there. The only time we ever start an IV on a child, first of all, if you're IV autonomous, the child has to be at least 2 years of age for PCPs to be authorized to start IVs, if I recall. But the only time you would ever start an IV on a child is if the kid is pre-arrest. If the kid is so altered mentally and without a reversible cause like hypoglycemia, where they're not even paying attention to you. You know, they're pretty flaccid and they require PPV. That's the only time. Other than that, we leave the child alone. The worry too is if they've got some sort of cardiac anomaly, the stress of being poked with a needle can just push them over the top and put them into heart failure or put them into crisis. Another not uncommon defect are ventricular septal defects or atrial septal defects, ASDs or VSDs. Now, before I go any further about cardiac anomalies, when you're working for a paramedic service, especially if you're working in a rural area, if you're ever called to transport a neonatal team from SickKids or Hamilton and take them to a hospital, if you get the opportunity to stay there with them, I would do that, because one, the nurses on the neonatal team are arguably the most knowledgeable nurses in the country, and two, even more knowledgeable than nurse practitioners, and two, they're usually pretty eager to teach and very willing to teach if you're eager to learn. So lots and lots of questions you can ask and lots of things you can learn if you have the opportunity to stick around. When you work area AMLs, you spend a lot of time with neonatal teams, and I had the good fortune of spending time with some of the most brilliant nurses in the country and learning about neonatology. So, and you'll encounter all of these kinds of things, VSDs, ASDs, patent ductus arteriosus, tetralogy of Fallot, lots and lots of preemie babies who require exogenous surfactant to keep them alive, lots of interesting stuff. So it's the second most common cardiac malformation. It occurs in about a fifth of congenital cardiac anomalies, usually diagnosed early during early childhood years. So these kids go home healthy, right? And it's only later on that they discover there's something wrong with this kid. And so the clinical presentation may vary depending on just how big that hole is. But heart failure can happen in the first 6 months of life. So if you're, if mom calls you and it's the first time this baby has ever been distressed, you know, it's a 6 month old, and you listen to the chest and you hear crackles, don't get into denial. Because I worked with a medic once, he said, this kid can't have crackles, like he's only like a 4 month old. But the kid was in failure. And so it can happen. And did we know what was going on exactly? No, not at the time, but that happens. And that's, the hospital's gonna wanna know you're coming in with a 6 month old or 4 month old who's in respiratory distress and has diffuse bilateral crackles. That'll set off some alarm bells in the emergency department. They'll be calling down pediatrics and, you know, they'll be freaking out. So if you think you're freaking out, they're freaking out. So a large VSD, you know, may present with dyspnea, a history of feeding difficulties, some poor growth, profuse perspiration, which is really unusual in infants, right? Recurring pulmonary infections, cardiac failure in early infancy, cyanosis is often absent, but they may be dusky in color, sort of a grayish color, especially when they're battling an infection. So management is largely supportive, right? Vital signs, SpO2, ECG, glucometry, if their mental status is altered in any way, shape, or form, and then support the ABCs. O2 PRN, unless the parent tells you no. We don't treat with nitroglycerin for a heart failure associated with VSD, and they're too young anyway. PPV PRN, IV only if it looks like they're going to need fluids or medication, which is unusual. And if they've got crackles, we don't give fluids to people with crackles, adults or kids. Or if they've got pulmonary edema, they don't get fluids, because we don't want to add to that fluid in the pulmonary circulation. And if they're in cardiac arrest, we just treat them as per usual for cardiac arrest. I thought these bullet points were automated, but unfortunately not. So hypoplastic left ventricle, that means that they've got a left ventricle that didn't develop. It's really, really tiny. And sometimes they'll do operations in utero for these kids to fix that left ventricle because it's not really compatible with life. So the left side hasn't developed properly, and the mitral and aortic valves may be tiny or absent. And this may be a kid where the patent ductus arteriosus is the only thing keeping that kid alive. And they may have aortic or mitral stenosis, which is a stiffening. Or atresia, which is absence of a normal opening or failure for the structure to be tubular. And very high risk of death in the first week of life. So I can tell you that, you know, if I ever get a code for a call for a kid in the first 28 days, who's in distress, especially respiratory distress, my anal sphincter tone is pretty high. It's probably an image you didn't need, but just telling you. But I'm looking calm on the outside, because it's all about having butterflies and making them fly in formation. Right. So hypoplastic left heart syndrome, the frequency is about 0.16 to 0.36 per 1,000 births in the US. It accounts for 7 to 9% of congenital heart disease, typically diagnosed in the first year of life. And without surgery, these kids usually die in the first 2 weeks of life. Oftentimes it's picked up in ultrasound during, you know, while mom's still in her second or third trimester. And if she's close to a surgical center for fetuses, they'll do the surgery in utero, repair that ventricle at that time. So the fetus might otherwise grow normally, develop normally, because the fetal circulation is different from the extrauterine circulation. And so they may actually appear perfectly normal at birth if it hasn't been discovered in ultrasound. So signs and symptoms typically present in 24 to 48 hours. So they usually send mom home pretty quickly, you know, within a couple of days. But hopefully anything like that with the baby is picked up in those first 24, 36 hours, rather. So they may present with respiratory distress, persistent recurring central cyanosis. So this is history stuff that we take, right? When mom or dad calls because of baby's distress, if the baby looks fine on the scene, we've got a few minutes to take some information down. If the baby looks unwell, we'll get moving quickly. Baby in a car seat, move to the ambulance, ask mom questions on the back of the ambulance. We're gonna ask about things like, you know, what happened today? Did he have an apneic period? Did he turn blue? How long was he blue for? Was he doing something when he turned blue? Like, was he crawling or something? Although that would be unusual in a couple of weeks, but has this happened before? You know, if these are reoccurring things. Does the baby seem unusually quiet or sleepy? They may be hypothermic, they may be tachycardic. Again, IVs only if the kid is pre-arrest, and cardiac arrest management we do as usual. So, that's a big smile, eh? Hang on a second here. This is driving me a little bonkers. You guys mind if I do this? Let me pause the recording. Let's talk about transposition of the great artery, so TGA. So this is what they call the most common cyanotic congenital heart lesion that presents in neonates. So don't assume that if you get a call for a cyanosed neonate that it's going to be a transposition of the great arteries, but could be really anything because there's so much crossover between signs and symptoms. Normally the aorta comes up from the left ventricle. In TGA, it comes up from the right ventricle, and the pulmonary artery arises from the left. So it's just opposite, right? It's transposition. And about a third of TGAs, the coronary artery anatomy is abnormal as well. And so one or all of the following abnormalities can present with a TGA. They can have also an atrial septal defect, ventricular septal defect, a patent ductus arteriosus, and in some cases the ASDs and VSDs might be essential for keeping those kids alive because they've got that transposition, right? Because otherwise you wouldn't get that blood oxygenated adequately. So they may be dependent on those ASDs and VSDs. And this is why I say, you know, we know oxygen therapy alters things, sometimes causes vessels to constrict, may do other things that I'm not familiar with. And so, you know, if the parent says, under no circumstances is my kid to get oxygen, they don't get oxygen. It's that simple, right? One of the things you'll learn in medicine is sometimes things seem completely counterintuitive, but the evidence has shown that's just the way it is. So mortality in untreated kids with TGA is about 30% in the first week, 50% in the first month, and 90% by the end of the first year. Really high, right? So I'm pretty sure this is another one of the surgeries they can do in vitro, before the baby is born. Pretty amazing stuff. Amazing stuff. So the left is what a normal circulation would look like. The right is transposition. Why that happens, Lord knows. So signs and symptoms, it's generally genetic, and you'll see, you know, TGA, and you'll see other cardiac anomalies in certain ethnicities. It's more common in certain ethnicities. Even things like dextrocardia, which is where the heart is flipped on the other side. So signs and symptoms for TGA include extreme cyanosis at birth. So again, this comes down to history taking, right? Tell me about when the baby was born. Were there any complications during the birth? And mom will know. She'll say, you know, my baby was blue for the longest time, and that should be a red flag. Right now, are you going to remember in 5 years' time the signs of TGA? I don't know, but if you review it on a regular basis, or you know, you've got some notes somewhere you can review on your way to a call like this, then great. And that's proportional to the degree of left ventricular pulmonary outflow, tract obstruction, and there may be signs of heart failure, and that may occur earlier or later. So we do the usual, monitor SpO2, ECG, glucometry for any altered mental status, supportive care, ABCs, O2, PRN, PPV, PRN. Again, IV only if they're pre-arrest, basically, if they're, you know, nearly unresponsive and they're going downhill. And then cardiac arrest management as per usual. Tetralogy of Fallot is a really complicated set of cardiac anomalies. And the only reason I remember sort of the basics of tetralogy is because I teach it every year. If I was in the field, unless I reviewed this on a regular basis or decided for some bizarre reason to commit it to memory, I wouldn't know it. But interesting, you know, I talk about niches, and one of the most satisfying things about career in paramedicine is if you develop niche knowledge in certain areas that sort of put you above and beyond most other paramedics, because paramedics have a great deal of respect for your knowledge in that area, and they'll come to you for information about those certain things. And examples of niche knowledge would include things like neonatology, pediatrics. Toxicology is another subject area most medics are weak in. If you had expertise in toxicology, that would be really valuable knowledge base to have. Rhythm and 12-lead interpretation, another area. Ultrasound. It's always fun to pursue a niche if you have a passion for it. You know, if you have a passion for neonates or peds, go for it. So features of tetralogy of Fallot include subaortic ventricular septal defects, pulmonary stenosis. They may or may not have a right ventricular outflow tract obstruction, meaning the interventricular septum may be enlarged or may impede blood flow out of the right side, or maybe pulmonary valve obstruction or stenosis. Aortic valve is typically positioned overriding the right ventricle, which is not good. They may have right ventricular hypertrophy. And so there's a list of what some of those things may look like. So pulmonary stenosis means a stiffening of the pulmonary artery, so it might be a problem with outflow of blood on that side. And there may be thickening of the right ventricle, maybe a VSD, ventricular septal defect. The aorta overrides the septal defect, and so that VSD may be, that mixing of venous arterial blood may be necessary to keep that baby alive until they can get surgery. And they do that sort of surgery at SickKids. It's pretty amazing. So tetralogy represents about 10% of cases of congenital heart disease. That's fairly high. The mortality rate is about 25% if they're untreated, and they've got a right ventricular outflow obstruction. They'll die within the first year of life. 40% by 4 years, 70% by 10 years. So imagine this. Some of these kids have tetralogy, but it goes undiscovered for a few years. That's really shocking. So the message to parents should be, you know, if your kid is ill in any way, even for a brief period of time, you get them in to be seen, right, to be assessed. So signs and symptoms may include cyanosis, poor feeding, fussiness, agitation, tachypnea. Very vague, right? Like, how would you know? You wouldn't. You just have to have that kid assessed in the hospital with ultrasound. Dyspnea on exertion. Okay, that would be a red flag in a small kid. This is interesting. So squatting is uniquely characteristic of right to left shunt in an exercising child. So if a kid's a year old and they have to squat, you know, get down on their knees with their legs, their thighs, and their ankles to catch their breath. That would be a red flag. Girth weight is low. Growth is retarded. Development and puberty may be delayed. So the kids in distress, the usual stuff. Supportive care. An IV only if they need fluids or medications, which means they're pre-arrest, essentially. Coarctation of the aorta. This is kind of an interesting one. You can see just beyond the left subclavian artery, in this case, the kink isn't always there, but it's often just past the left subclavian artery. There's a kink in the aorta, and so there's obstruction of blood flow beyond that aortic arch. So it's so typically located distal to the origin of the left subclavian artery, at about the level of the ductal structure, and it's a relatively common defect, 5 to 8% of congenital anomalies, commonly associated with PDA and VSD, or aortic stenosis. And they present, so they may present with heart failure, they may present in a shock state, they have typically a slower clinical presentation, and so left ventricular afterload may be just more gradual if they've got a smaller coarctation of the aorta. And the other thing that's unique is that they may have good blood flow and color to their lower extremities and poor blood flow to the upper extremities, particularly the left side. And so, you know, if you've got a small child who's cyanosed in the one arm, but has good color and perfusion in the legs, that would raise your suspicion of something like a coarctation. So newborns typically present with tachypnea and tachycardia, pink upper extremities with cyanosed lower extremities. Pink upper extremities, and that's because the kink happens beyond the subclavian artery. So the right subclavian and left subclavian get good blood flow, but it's poor circulation in the lower extremity. So sorry about that. So lower extremity cyanosis or poor perfusion. And pulses may be palpable in the upper extremities, but reduced in the lower extremities. The infant or child, you can compare BPs, but quite frankly, I don't know that that's a justifiable pre-hospital assessment to do. If you're going to compare BPs, you're probably looking at BPs by palpation rather than auscultation, right? So if you're taking a blood pressure in the lower extremity, for example, you'd wrap the cuff around the calf and palpate a posterior tibial pulse or a pedal pulse and look for systolic blood pressure. So the left arm may be lower than the right arm depending on where the coarctation is exactly, and the diagnosis is often delayed until the patient develops congestive heart failure. Let me just... persistent pulmonary hypertension of the newborn, PPHN. Seen a few babies with PPHN with the neonate team. So in some newborns, typically after a baby's born and they make the switch from fetal circulation to normal circulation, the pulmonary vessels relax as a result of air entering the lungs. But in some babies that doesn't happen, and where the circulation doesn't quite transition the way you'd expect, and the result is PPHN, and often results when the vessels constrict in response to alveolar hypoxia or hypoventilation. So it's important in the newborn to recognize a baby is not vigorous, who requires PPV, requires oxygenation if needed, and to address that. And it can also be due to parenchymal disorders, such as hyalomemory disease, newborns who've aspirated meconium, or they have lung hypoplasia, so they've got a small set of lungs, they've not quite developed, or they've got congenital diaphragmatic hernia, where the stomach contents are actually above the diaphragm. We'll take a look at that in one second here. So care, again, is supportive. Recognition of any of these cardiac anomalies, probably going to be elusive. Again, to get back to my original point, you have a baby who's sick, or mom tells you they were sick before you got there, then consider them sick and consider it serious and transport them to the hospital. Because watch out for moms and dads who say, he's fine now, do we really need to go to the hospital? My answer is always, yep, because we don't know, we need to find out, right? Kid who's apneic and cyanosed might be no big deal at all, but as a paramedic and as a parent, I'm not going to take any chances. I'm going to err on the side of the caution. I'm going to advocate for the best interest of that baby, and I'm going to take that baby to the hospital where they can do, you know, observe the kid longer, do some workup on that baby to find out if there's anything abnormal. They can spend more time taking a history, something you and I don't have the luxury of doing because we're usually under, you know, time constraints, the pressure to get off the scene in under 20 minutes, under 10 minutes in traumas and things. So congenital diaphragmatic hernia, this happens in utero, happens before birth, but we also see, I think we talked about last year, but traumatic diaphragmatic hernia, which is a really rare injury where someone is struck in the abdomen with so much force it pushes the abdominal contents up above the hemidiaphragm, typically above the left diaphragm. So they present with respiratory distress cyanosis. The abdominal organs are above the diaphragm, but 85% on the left side. So there's usually some degree of hypoplasia of the left lung. The left lung hasn't fully developed. And frequency is about one in every 2,000 to 3,000 births, so not terribly common. And the mortality rate, live births, is generally reported in as 40 to 62%, quite high. So signs and symptoms, they're typically going to be in respiratory distress. You may notice the abdomen is scaphoid, meaning it's because the abdominal contents are not in the abdomen, they're actually in the left chest. The belly appears to be concave. You've got scaphoiding, if you will, of the abdomen, like a shaped like a boat, a barrel-shaped chest, if you're in a large chest, because of that stomach content in there, respiratory distress, retraction, cyanosis, grunting respirations. If you auscultate the chest, what you'll hear on the left side is typically an absence of breath sounds, and you may hear bowel sounds in the left chest. That would be a telltale sign, and that's basically what it looks like. That's what it looks like on an x-ray. So you can see, on this x-ray, the right lung looks perfectly normal. We've got those spider-like projections of vessels in the lungs, and we've got that radio opacification, that blackness of air. But over here, we've got these what look like bubbles, and that's gastrointestinal tract, essentially in the above the left hemidiaphragm. That's all stomach and intestinal content up there. You can see this is a kid who's endotracheally intubated. This is an endotracheal tube right there. And this is a gastric tube, so they put a gastric tube down there. And the idea is to try to take out air from the GI tract that's up in the chest to shrink that anomaly, to allow that left lung to expand a little better. There's another example. This is a kid who also looks like they're endotracheally intubated. I see a tube here that's a little shy. It's not very deep. Because the carina is about here, so the tube's a little shallow. But there's a gastric tube in here. You can see it has that radio opaque line on it. And basically what they do is they just surgically cut the diaphragm and pull the gut out of the chest and back into the gut where it belongs. Pretty basic stuff. So in terms of care, I've never heard of a baby going home with diaphragmatic hernia. I think this is something that's usually detected, if not in utero, right at birth. But if we were called to that sort of thing, the care is largely supportive, usual stuff. So in summary, management is largely supportive. Airway and breathing is really always the critical stuff. Oxygenate if low saturating, PPV if altered mental status and not ventilating adequately, not oxygenating adequately. unless mom or dad tells you otherwise. And when it comes to ventilation in newborns and infants, we have to be just extraordinarily cautious because they have very tiny lungs. And we don't want to get air in their gut, and we don't want to get too much air in their lungs and cause a pneumothorax. So important to have a basic understanding of the pathophysiology. I'm assuming you guys haven't covered cardiac anomalies in patho yet. Some last year, last semester. Okay, good, good. And really, it's recognizing and acknowledging that the kid is sick or was sick before you got there, and transporting and advocating for the patient and reassuring the parents that they did the right thing calling you. Because I've had a lot of parents call, and they, you know, once the baby looked good, was no longer blue, they felt really bad about calling us. And, you know, they really wanted to know they did the right thing, and I always assure them they did the right thing. You know, absolutely. This is what I would do with my child, and you did the right thing. Beautiful that we have universal healthcare. I've done a lot of write-ups in the U.S. where calls get canceled left, right, and center, and I just can't imagine the horror of debating whether to take your child to the hospital based on what it's going to cost you. I can't imagine living like that. I just can't. Just can't. So, in summary, keep the infant with mom or dad, SpO2, O2 as needed, unless contraindicated, ECG, glucometry for any altered LOC, and the usual things. Any questions about cardiac anomalies in kids?